Right, so thanks for the invitation to come to this workshop and also to give a talk on some of my work. So the work I'm going to talk about was kind of mostly in these two papers. And the plan is going to be, first I'll try to give some just general motivation for why you might want to go to F-theory to look for interesting looking gut. And then, in this context, I want to talk about one particular structure that seems to be playing an interesting role in certain aspects of these models, which is the presence of an E8-type structure. And then I'll ask if I try to embed the supersymmetry breaking sector inside of the E8, this E8 singularity as well, what do I learn about, say minimal gauge mediation models in this context? And see that in many cases, it looks like over some range of parameter space, something like the Stau comes out as an NLSP. And then I'll ask, what are the signatures of that? And then wrap up with conclusions. OK, so what's the main motivation? Well, so the main idea is to ask, how does something like the standard model embed inside of something like string theory? So that's kind of broad. So the strategy I'm going to do to ask how I can try and connect from, say, low-energy physics up to high-energy physics is really that I'm not going to assume that I have a full compactification and that I can just work out all the consequences of it at low energies, but rather I'm going to build from the bottom up. So the idea is going to be that I'm going to try and get the details of the standard model correct first, and then I'm going to start worrying about other things related to my compactification later. So I'm going to try and defer gravity as much as I can. And in this context, one natural way to try and do this is to try and use open strings for this piece of it, and closed strings for, say, gravity. Okay. So the main idea here is that you might say this is going to be a little too flexible, but the question is going to be, if I start demanding specific structures in the open string sector, what do I learn about constraints in other pieces of the open string sector? It's not guaranteed that I'll learn anything, but what we're going to see is that actually if you start to demand kind of some minimal requirements about unification, it starts to constrain things a little bit in the open string sector. Okay, so what are the main assumptions I'm going to do? So to get things started. So if I leave it at this kind of broad level, it's going to be a little too flexible. So the main things I'm going to assume are, number one, some kind of 40 n equals 1 supersymmetry. And number two, if I look at, say, the way that the gauge couplings of the standard model run, once I include the superpartners in the MSM, it looks like the couplings all unify at some higher scale. So that's the next thing I'm going to assume. There exists some kind of gut, or more precisely, gut-like structures. It's not really going to be, say, a gut in the sense of a 4D gut, but it could be a gut in the sense of a higher dimensional type gut. So I'm going to demand something like gut-like structures. Okay, so what do I mean by this? Okay, so let's just recall that we have, say, in the standard model, we have, say, so by gut-like structures, I'm going to mean take these guys, fit them inside of, say, SU5. So I have, say, the 10 for these guys, another one for, say, the downs and leptons. And these guys can be fit inside of, say, 5 bar and 5. So that's at the level of matter content. And then there are two interaction terms one would like to have present in the Lagrangian. One is a 5-10-10 coupling, so to speak, and the other one is, say, a 5-bar-10 coupling. Okay, so that's kind of the minimal matter content I need if I want to get started with something like a gut-like structure. And then the other thing I need is I need to have these interaction terms be present. And this one is, for example, useful for, say, getting the bottom quark mass, and this one is useful for getting, say, the top quark mass once the Higgs develop suitable BEPS. Okay, now the problem, kind of well known at this point, is that if I try to work with just perturbative open string theory, so just at the level of string perturbation theory, the one problematic feature of just trying to use open strings to make the standard model in the context of gut models is that you can generate this type of coupling. This one does not seem to be generated in string perturbation theory. And the reason is that, well, crudely, the number of boxes does not equal the number of box bars. The number of fundamental indices is different from the number of anti-fundamental indices. And that makes it difficult to generate this coupling. And that's a potential problem if I just work at the level of string perturbation theory. We know the top quark is quite heavy. It's, in fact, the heaviest quark we have around. So we need to look for some extra ingredient to kind of make this coupling come out big. Okay, so this at least suggests, so when we work in G-string a lot less than one, we have, say, open strings. But we might say, well, what if we start working at more general values of the string coupling? Let's allow it to be now an order one parameter. So new ingredients can start to enter the model building regime. Namely, you can start to now form things like PQ string junctions, things like this. So these can provide us with new ingredients to potentially get around these kind of problems. Okay, so that's going to be kind of the motivation here. Or that is the motivation here. Going to G-string order one, and this really suggests I'm interested in doing this kind of game, playing with F theory. So that's where I'm going to head. So that's kind of the broad motivation for why just kind of at a minimal level, if I try to build from the bottom up, say, standard model, looks like I want to have extra ingredients in the story. Okay, so what's F theory? So my view on this is going to be that I'm just going to view it as kind of 2B, a strongly coupled formulation. Of 2B, in which we take the axion dilaton of 2B, which is this thing. And we view it as a geometric parameter of a 12D geometry. So the idea is that this tau here can be interpreted as the shape or a complex structure modulus of an elliptic curve. Or and so we can view it as kind of a parallelogram with parallel sides identified. And then the SL2Z action of, say, 2B then gets mapped to, say, a geometric quantity here. So we're going to be interested in 4D n equals 1 supersymmetric vacua. And what does that mean? That means we want to take our 12-dimensional theory and compactify it on Calabi-Yau 4-fold. Well, more precisely, an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau 4-fold. Elliptic because we have imagine that there's a two torus fibered over every point. So the idea is basically that I can describe the way this two torus looks in terms of, say, some Weierstrass model, which I think was discussed 2 weeks ago, or anyway, there was some discussion of this already, where these Fs and Gs kind of depend on where we are in the actual space-time directions, the 10 space-time directions. Okay, and then, so the picture we should have in mind here is that the Calabi-Yau 4-fold roughly looks like some blob. There's some complex 3-fold base, or some 6-real-dimensional manifold. And then over every point of this, we have the shape, we have this elliptic curve, or this 2-torus, and it can look like this. So at various points, it could look like a smooth curve, or at other points, it could look like it's pinching off. And the places where it pinches off at, I think I'll call the discriminant, which is where delta equals 0. And this is where delta is equal to, basically, the discriminant of this cubic in x. That's where two of the roots are meeting. So what is this? This is a function that depends on the coordinates we have in the threefold. So what it does is it sweeps out some hypersurface inside of the threefold. So it corresponds to something that fills out two complex dimensions. And in general, it'll factorize, or it can factorize into various components. What we do is we say, when we see it pinching off like this, along some hypersurface like this, this is where a 7-brain is located. Okay. So the setup is going to be, at a kind of a broad level, that we're going to imagine building the gut. The gut is going to be stuck on the gut, SU5 is going to be stuck here. And then there can be other places where we have other pieces of the discriminant coming in. So we could say there's a delta gut, say, located here. But then there could be other 7-brains coming in. We could cut the 7-brain in various locations. So this could be some other, say, delta prime or delta double prime. Now, we know what to expect in the context of, say, perturbative strings when we have, say, seven brains intersecting. That means that we have, say, matter localized along those intersections. So that's what we're going to be expecting here. So the first thing we have to do is we have to figure out, given like the degeneration of the fibra over this delta gut, we want to know what's the low energy content of that theory. Okay, so what's the low energy content test given this kind of geometric idea? So the idea is that if I give you, say, F theory, compactified now, let's say I compactify it on, say, something that looks like, well, let me just write it like this, an ADE type singularity controlled by the singular fiber directions here, fibered over some complex surface S. So the idea here is that this S is going to be like delta gut equals zero. This gives you 8D Supriang mills with a corresponding gauge group. Of ADE type. Okay, so that's the main idea, that this is how we're going to get the gauge theory. So if I want something like SU5 over this thing, so I want something like SU5 corresponds to a particular type of ADE type singularity. Namely, well, this can be written as like A4 type singularity, something like that. But I'm just going to stick at the level of kind of group theory language with SU5s and all that.
You're using that F theory on K3 is like, you're using something like that?
That's right. So locally it's going to look like F theory on, say, K3. So the point is that if I look at K3 and I imagine it has some singular degeneration, it'll look like locally like an ADE type singularity. The ADE type is then indeed what I'm doing. Okay. So what are the ingredients we're going to put into the story? So the idea is that, okay, well, we already mentioned this one. We want to have the gut, and that's in 8D. And so we have, say, the ADE degeneration over this entire complex surface. And this is over S. So this is some four real dimensional manifold. So let me just write the complex dimension here. You see two complex dimensions. Okay, now, over intersections of the gut with other things, we can have in, say, six dimensions over, say, a complex curve or a Riemann surface in internal directions. This can also occur. And then we can have, say, the other thing happening, the other dimension, 40 points. So what are the ingredients associated with this? This one we had was coming from, it was going to give us a gauge theory. Here, we get matter. And here you get things like Yukawas. Now, how are we going to figure out what the matter content is localized around here? The idea is that we can view this as kind of a higher rank gauge theory, which is being broken down by the geometry, the patch at least, to something like, in minimal cases, like GS times, say, some U1 factor. So what we can do is we can view this in terms of a field. It'll be a wave equation like this. And the breaking from G sigma down to GS times U1 can be parameterized in terms of, say, some adjoint valued guy, some adjoint valued field valued in this gauge group down to there. This is some wave equation for it. Once this guy develops a VEV, what we'll see is that the matter will be localized precisely where this VEV vanishes. That's where we have the symmetry enhancement back up to, say, G sigma. So what we get is we get matter trapped along subspaces, and that's precisely where these guys are located.
Is it possible to get chiral matter just from intersections, or is one force related
to
the gauge blocks on the brain?
So it'll be chiral matter in the sense of six-dimensional fields, but
it's not chiral anymore.
That's right. So it's not chiral at this point. So I have to do more to get something closer to the standard model. And the extra ingredient is indeed to turn on gauge field fluxes. So the idea is that once I turn on flux, you can start to get a chiral matter spectrum. How does that work? The idea is that you have, say a 6D field. Let's now look at the profile of the 6D field. So it'll be obeying some kind of six-dimensional Dirac equation like this. We can decompose that into a 4D piece. Like this. So we can split it up in terms of the Dirac operator on the curve and Dirac operator in, say, 4D. And what we're interested in is getting massless modes out in four dimensions. That means we're interested in counting how many guys are annihilated by this operator. So this is now an index theory problem. And the number of generations, or number of zero modes of chirality, given chirality, will then be given by integrating that over the integrating the flux that we turned on over the matter curve. So that's how we get now 4D chiral matter to come out.
Question, Don?
Yeah.
So I guess if I've understood correctly, the G sigma is not really a real symmetry. It's something that you use to categorize the matter, but there are sort of exotic situations, right, where that's not really a real.
That's right. So I mean, there's no, okay. So if you work globally over the entire compactification, there's no sense in which, there's not always a sense in which you can take the two seven grains and tilt them back on top of each other. Sometimes there will be an obstruction to that. So in that sense, there's never really the G sigma. However, if I work in patches, I can use this to figure out where the localized matter is. So yeah.
So it's sort of a tool to get the matter out. But
that's right. Yeah. Yeah. But you can check it in cases where you can do this deformation.
Right.
And in those cases, it agrees as you'd expect. So.
So other ways of getting chiral matter, just dealing with single grain and putting a flux on it. Not starting from intersection.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In the last stage, right? So
that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Geometry.
Yeah, so.
That you also have in this context.
That's right. So in that context, actually, that'll bring me actually to the next point, which is how you break the gut group. So let's say I started with, say, an SU5 gut, and I wanted to get, say, matter that was, you know, coming from, say, the breaking pattern of SU5 down to, say, the standard model. So what would you start with? You'd start with something that's in the, say, the adjoint of 24 of that SU5, and you could break it down into, say, the adjoints of these guys, plus, so actually, these guys are kind of undesirable at the level of low energy phenomenology, because the representation from good for these guys is actually not something you see in the standard model. So one wants to turn on a flux so that these guys are excluded. Flux. But such that this flux excludes these guys. Okay, so the flux that you turns on here is typically the hypercharge direction, which at the level of the algebra of SU5, it'll look like this direction. The point is that once I turn on this flux, the group that will be left over in four dimensions is the one that commutes with these generators. That'll be the SU3, SU2, and the U1 factor. I'm going to put them at the gut scale, roughly. So the idea is that the characteristic scale is going to be roughly set by the overall radius of the.
So the gut scale is the KK scale, basically.
Roughly. Although there's been some discussion about, you know, whether they're identical or not. So anyway, maybe we should ask people in the audience about this more. But anyway, it's roughly the same scale. So the idea is that roughly, you know, the KK breaking scale is roughly KK scale is roughly the same as the gut breaking scale.
There's some global obstructions to putting fluxes like that, and you have to worry about global conditions.
That's right. I suspect Natalia is going to talk about this a little bit more. So, but yeah, there's a topological condition when it puts on the compactification so that the flux looks non-trivial on the base, on the gut surface, but then when we complete it into the full compactification, it has to look like a trivial cycle in the full threefold.
Sorry, John, can you just say a little bit more about the nature of the flux in the F-theory language? I mean, the flux, this is like G-flux?
You can view it as kind of a localized version of a G-flux that kind of localizes on the 7-brain.
It's a flux localized on the 7-brain, so it's not included in the Weierstrass language in F-theory. It's some additional data you're putting in. Is that correct?
Yeah. So from the perspective of, say, the F-theory compactification, what would I have to tell a mathematician in order to, like, make this a well-defined problem?
That's exactly my question.
Yeah. So I would have to tell them a Calabi-Yau fourfold,
yes.
And then I would also have to tell them a G-flux, or something like a set of G-fluxes to activate. And those G-fluxes are these kind of things. I'm describing it in 7-brain language, but you'd want to turn on some G-fluxes in general and then ask, okay, now I'm going to ask you, what's the zero-mode spectrum for that? And that would be at least more well-posed.
So these G-fluxes live in the H2 of the fourfold?
No, H4. The G-fluxes would live in H4.
They're going to the T2 point.
Yeah, right. So I'm actually working in, say, the dual M-theory picture. So it's not really correct to call it, say, a G-flux on the F-theory side. It's more like a three-flux which suffers from monodromies and blah, blah, blah.
But, yeah, that's where I guess I'm trying to understand. But there's only really two legs of that.
Right, so the G-flux, let's say we're working in the M-theory language. We'd say we have some four-form flux. Now let's go over to the F-theory side. We can decompose this as, say some elliptic directions like this. I guess where this z-coordinate is the direction along the elliptic curve. So roughly what we're doing is we're activating something like this thing, but it's localized on the 7-brain. I mean, it's usually phrased in terms of just turning on a four-form flux because it's easier to state in that language.
Can I say a related question about what the mathematician would say about this? So before you added the flux, you had a certain singularity structure.
Yeah.
You reinforced it. When you add the flux, you've broken that. So in some sense, you've made the singularity more mild. Is this something that a mathematician, I mean, is this a...
Oh, would they be able to see that the singularity got milder?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Well,
physically, it is milder.
The group was Higgs, right? The singularity has to do with enhanced gauge symmetry. The gauge symmetry has now been
broken. Has more to do with the membrane states that would wrap these blown up curves they get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing they would be able to see at the level of the Calabi-Yau fourfold is, say, complex structure deformations of the Calabi-Yau fourfold. So they could see types of Higgsings, but they wouldn't. I don't think they would see the one coming from, say, fluxes. Yeah, so they could see, so let's say I didn't put this on, say, a rigid complex surface, so I could move it around and stuff, then you could see that at the level of the geometry. So you could imagine taking these brains and moving them off like that. That you could see at the level of a deformation of the Weierstrass model.
Right, exactly, but this is not that.
That's not that, exactly.
Yeah, so there's something more than...
These are M2s that become massive because of the flux you turned on. Yeah. They can't wrap certain of these these blow-up mm-hmm. curves. That's mm-hmm. what's happening.
Right. I'm just wondering if there is a mathematical way to sort of capture that.
I think that's. Okay, I'm sure there's a way to do it, but I don't know off the top of my head. you wouldn't see it though at the level of the complex structures of the Calabi-Yau fourfold.
Is it fair to say that this flux that you put on is basically the one in type 2b? Because you're really concerned about the flux on the 7-brain only. You're not addressing going beyond, you know. You define it only on the 7-brains, right? So it's pullback.
Well, okay, so the... Typically, the flux one turns on in this context will be something that's present not just on this 7-brain, but on other 7-brains also in the story. So you'll have the gut brain, and you also have the other one. The reason why this comes up is that there's quantization conditions one wants to put on the flux. And in particular, one wants to look at things that naively would look like they're, you know, poorly quantized on just an isolated 7-brain. So this has to be fit inside of something like this actually has to be fit inside of things like, you know, E-type structures in order to really make sense of it in kind of a more global setting. So I don't know if you can really phrase it fully in 2B. There are analogous fluxes one can turn on in 2B, but I don't think they're exactly the same ones.
Sorry, just one more question, then I'll leave you alone. So if you think of the F-theory compactification as being on a smooth Calabi-Yau fourfold,
yeah.
Is there some way of encoding these fluxes in the language of the smooth Calabi-Yau fourfold? Is there like some bundle over that or something that you can talk about them in terms of? Or is this just, should we just think of this as auxiliary data in addition to the discriminant locus?
I think it's auxiliary data. You would say that there's an element of H lower 4, or, okay, at this crude level, H lower 4 of, say, you know, this thing.
Of the smooth complete Calabi-Yau.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but how do you get your index theory? Don't you have to start from some kind of cohomology?
It's relative cohomology. I mean, it's not...
That's right. It's enough for me to just talk about... So the point is this G-flux is kind of... It's a curious guy in that it's trying to localize on the 7-brain. So I can talk about it in gauge theory language, which is the way I'm talking about it here. But indeed, you know, if you want to talk about more global things, you then have to face how this thing looks like over the entire Calabi-Yau fourfold, and then you know you have to really define this thing, you know, as an object in its own right. Okay, let's see. Maybe actually, what time did I start?
It's quarter to 11, so
okay. Okay. Okay, no problem. Okay, no problem. So let me just provide one example of kind of this matter localization at the level of the geometry, just so we see how it goes. I'll get rid of this. So let's say that we had, say, at some point in our geometry, E6 type singularity. So let's say that now let's say I'm looking at, let's zoom in on the just the delta gut complex surface. So it's some four real dimensional manifold. And let's say that inside of it, I have some point where it's E6. Let's say it's SU5 over the whole complex surface. And let's say that there's some point of E6, and let's say that there's like this. Okay, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to describe locally what this looks like. So what I can do is I can start from the E6, and the 78 of E6, namely the adjoint, and let's break it down now into, say, FC5 times, let's say there's a breaking pattern like this, dictated by the geometry, where this thing splits up as, say, okay, a bunch of adjoints, and then plus conjugates of these guys. Oh, and then plus a singlet. Okay. So we say that whenever we have a particular direction where the E6 guy got Higgs, we say this is where matter got localized. So we see that there's in principle three directions. In general, there'll be just two. Where you have, say, there's a U1 inside of here, and you'll have, say, locations where these things enhance up. So this is where the 10 is, enhancement from SU5 to SO10, and this is where the 5 is, along enhancement from, say, SU5 to SU6.
Okay. There's
a point here.
Sir, can I make sure I understand the picture? So the SU6 is on a complex codimension 2 locus, is that right?
Complex codimension 2 with respect to the complex threefold.
Yeah, okay, yes. Good. And the SO10 is the same. So those are already intersections between the S.
Yes, and
something else. And so the E6 is actually complex codimension 3.
That's right. It's at a point of the geometry. So
there's no E6 gauge.
That's right. There's no E6 gauge theory. That's right. There's no E6 gauge theory. But what there is this E6 singularity. And what we want to do is figure out what's the.
So that means F and G degenerate in a certain way.
That's right. So it'll look like it's an E6 singularity at that point.
F of this vector B and G of this vector B, and you're basically saying if you treated all the components of that the same, it would look like an E6 singularity that you get at codimension 1. I mean, can you say a little bit more about what it is in terms of F and G?
So what you'll have in general is it'll look like, F and G will look, so what do you get? You'll get something like this, and then delta will locally look like, so let's introduce a local coordinate where the this guy is, I'll call it Z. So z equals 0. Delta will locally look like some z to the fifth for the SU5 piece. And then there will be a bunch of other stuff inside of here. I'll just write down a general polynomial like this. What we're doing is we're saying, now let's look at where these guys vanish, and where we get a higher type of singularity type. So remember, the E6 type of singularity is, for example, if we were just working over this, and the value of delta would be given by z to the eighth times blah, blah, blah.
So that's a G from the G goes like z to the fourth, and then the zero.
Yeah, for this particular E6, for example.
Right, so, the one. So that part I understand.
That's right. So now what we're saying is take a look at these guys, and let's say that we have two curves like this, and let's say they meet at some point where this thing now has leading order behavior, not just z to the fifth, but now it's instead z to the eighth. So now it looks like z to the eighth, but only at this particular point.
Z is, what is z in terms of the three components of
z? Z is my local coordinate describing where the gut surface is.
So z is transverse to one of those zones.
So this is all taking place at, say, z equals.
Normal coordinate is gut inside this.
So locally you can imagine that, like, say the gut sits at some point like this, and then there's a coordinate z where this thing moves up along. So is that okay?
So the point of what you're doing here is you're trying to show us how you colorize this, is that correct?
That's right.
You have co-dimension 2 loci in which you get different matter fields, and you're trying to show us how this extra E6 gives you the couplings between those different matter content?
That's right. And so the point is that you can work out what kind of states are going to come out of this thing, or how they're going to interact based on things descending from 78 cubed. So what's one of the things that comes out of this? Okay, the 5-10-10. That's the thing we were missing. So you can note that it's invariant under, say, SU2, U1, and SU5, for example. The 5-10-10. And that was the guy that we were having problems with in the context of perturbative open strings. So that's the guy we're going to... So this suggests that if we want to be building gut models in this context, we should try and use E-type structures, E-type singularities, and have those in the story.
Is it clear that there are not other
Can I just ask one more thing about this? What is the difference between what you just described and what you would have gotten had you actually had an E6 enhanced symmetry?
So there are geometries where you could imagine that you could move the seven brains around. But the problem is that there's no sense in which I can, in general, there's no sense in which you can always bring the seven brains back on top of each other. You could have started from, say, an E6 gauge theory and started, just literally tilting the brains off. And then there would be some point where they all still meet, and that would be the sense in which you'd have, say, symmetry restoration of, say, E6.
Right, but at the level of the Weierstrass thing, you just got the Z actually happening.
Yeah, so what you could do? Yeah, so let's imagine a situation where, there wouldn't be an obstruction to bringing all the brains on top of each other. You'd start from E6, and then you'd start turning on lower deformations. And then what you would have at the end is something that looked like an SU5 over, say, the whole thing. And then you'd have, say, another seven brain coming in, where there's another component of the discriminant where this thing looks like it's enhancing to, say, SU6 or SO10. So in those cases, the problem is that, in general, you may not have available this picture of, like, tilting the brains globally. So, yeah.
Just quick, can you give some sort of systematic argument for this is one of the only things you can do to get this coupling? Maybe, like, from Dynkin diagrams or something, just show that there's a limited set of possibilities to get this coupling? Or is this just one you tried and it worked?
Oh, you mean...
I mean, you have E6, and this has the three things coming out, and you say that's going to give you the right coupling.
Yeah.
Is it possible there are other ways of doing it?
I could embed it inside E7 or E8.
Right, but you can sort of prove that it has to be one of the exceptional groups starting at E6 because of some threefold connectivity or something.
I think so. Another way of saying it is that if you tried to, let's say you embed it inside of an adjoint, then the other ones that one would try and build are ones you can represent as, say, the adjoints look like two tensor index representations, and that's why we can generate them at the level of, say, string perturbation theory anyway. Once I'm stuck with two index tensor representations, I run back into the same problem I had before, which is I'm going to typically have, when I try and make a gauge invariant object, something that has an equal number of boxes and box bars. So that's the obstruction I'm going to hit if I try and, say, use SO or SU to do it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
So just a very naive question. So the cubic coupling is just the one you inherit from maximized for symmetric superimages?
Yeah. So there's a structure constant that'll be there from, say, the breaking pattern of, say, E6. And so there's a structure constant associated with that.
The main thing to go to FTA is to have this exceptional.
Yeah. That's the thing I'm getting beyond, say, string perturbation theory. I'm getting now E's to come in the story.
But of course, this discussion has been before in the heterotic E8 times E8 string. As for example, a paper by Vattari and Tata, and I think one more collaborator, which is like 1 or 2 years older than the F theory context.
Yeah, you mean mapping, like, say, heterotic models to F theory models?
I mean, this discussion that you can have the U-carvers coming from an E6 structure is known from the heterotic E8 times E8 string. It's just then not at a singularity. But I mean, this whole...
That's right, yeah. That's right. Okay. So in light of time, maybe I'll skip a little bit about flavor, but I want to mention a couple things about flavor.
You can have plenty of time, right?
Well, you don't have to finish within an hour. It's not completely open-ended, but...
Okay. I think I'll go over here. Okay. Okay, so there are a couple things one might try to do in building now, just at a qualitative level. So what are the things we'd like to try and do? Okay. So let's again imagine we have our blob corresponding to, say, the SU5 7 brain. And this is along the component of this criminal locus. So delta cut equals 0. Now, what are the things I wanted? I wanted to have a 10 for my SU5 gut. I wanted to have 5 bar matter, and I wanted to have these guys. So what I'm going to minimally demand is that I have some curve where I have 10 matter. This is where I have, say, SO10 enhancement occurring. Then I have a curve where, say, 5 bar matter and, say, 5 bar Higgs. And these are both at SU6 enhancement. And then I have, say, 5 Higgs. So at this point, I had, say, the 5, 10, 10. At this point, I have, say, SO12. Okay, those are the minimal things I want to have. And by the way, the reason why I'm putting the Higgs's on different curves from, I mean, they're both 5, so you might say, why am I not putting them on the same curve as the 5 bar? Because I want to keep a full gut multiplet for the 5 bars, but I don't want to have a full gut multiplet for the Higgs's. I only want the Higgs doublets to be surviving at low energies.
So that's some kind of non-generic thing where you have 4 discriminant loci all fitting at one point?
No, I think it's... That's not right. It's generic in the sense of the way that once you include the ADE type structure.
Okay, it's sort of forced on you. You're saying once you have that singularity structure, you get the extra thing.
Right. So it's actually rather clear from the perspective of the gauge theory what's going on. So let's imagine that I had a system where I could write it as a gauge theory. What would I say is going on here? You'd say there's a breaking pattern, and once I specify enough of these guys enhancing, there can be an additional guy that just comes in. Now, that's not to say, though, that in this case you might say, well, how come I didn't draw 2 tens or something like that? In that case, the singularity type is such that at the level of complex structure deformations of the Calabi fourfold, it'll look like you want to identify the 2 ten curves. But at the level of the gauge theory, you know, it's on equal footing to describe in terms of, they're equally likely in terms of having, say, 2 tens or, say, 1 ten curve. But yeah. Okay. So what are the things to say here? So here's where we got our, say, 5, 10, 10 coupling. Here's where we got our 5 bar, 5 bar, 10 coupling. Okay. So now if we leave it at this, we can. There are ways to turn on fluxes to act to generate hierarchies now for the Kyle coupling. So the idea is that you have, say, Higgs. Let me just do one example like this. And then by turning on, say, a background Higgs flux, this can induce hierarchies. Okay, and then we can use things like dimensional analysis to estimate the size of these epsilon. And they come out in the right ballpark. But there's a problem here, which is that you can generate hierarchies for, say, so this will generate, say, a mass term hierarchy for this guy. You can do a similar thing for, say, the downs. So let me just write it as kind of a... But if you leave it at this very general level, where you kind of don't do anything else with these points, generically you'll have a problem with now the CKM matrix. So you can potentially generate hierarchical masses turning on the H fluxes like this. But the CKM matrix will come out very badly. It'll come out in the generic situation. CKM matrix will be an order one set of order one entries in the matrix. Why does that happen? That's happening because the way that we make the Yukawas is by, or the way that we evaluate the Yukawas is by taking the wave function associated with, say, the matter curve. It satisfies some Dirac type equation in the presence of, say, its background fluxes. And we evaluate the overlaps of those wave functions to make the Yukawa coupling, or to get the value of the Yukawa coupling. The problem here is that this guy, the quark double wave function, is participating in two Yukawas. It's participating in the up type Yukawa, And then there's a similar one that it participates in for the down-type Yukawa. Now, if I look at the profile of psi q, the quark doublet wave functions, there's the point over here, I'll call it p up, and there's a point over here, I'll call it p down. In general, psi q near p up has nothing at all to do with psi q near p down. So what does that mean? That means that since there's nothing relating these two, we can find a basis that will diagonalize the Yukawa and look roughly hierarchical, but that basis will in general be different. So what does that mean at the level of a CKM matrix? The CKM matrix is measuring for us the mismatch between those two bases, how much they are aligned in the same basis, flavor basis. So if I want to have more hierarchical flavor structure, I need to put these things closer together. The different generations came from, okay, so in this kind of minimal setup, I'm going to put all the generations on, say, from, where did I put it? Maybe I erased it. Okay, there's a flux that you turn on. The amount of flux going through the curve controls the number of generations. So if I demand a minimal setup, then we want one curve and three generations on that curve. And you could imagine doing things differently where you kind of put, you know, one generation here and then another generation and another.
The generations have to do with zero modes of the Dirac operator in the presence of that flux, so that the zeros are located at different places.
That's right.
So, and that's why you say they don't have anything to do with each other.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So in other words, you can, yeah. Yeah, so if these points are just located at different locations, the values of the wave functions that we got, the zero mode wave functions, they're just different, and there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, we could say, well, it's just an accident that we get hierarchical CKM. But then what we can do is we can say, kind of in a minimal setup, there's one thing that this suggests geometrically, and that's pushing these two points together. So in other words, taking this point and putting it on top of here. Now the objection we had earlier, namely that the values of the wave functions, like kind of the up and the down locations, they'll be the same. And you'll get something that looks roughly, so now these kind of transfer matrices going from one point to the other will now be roughly identity. And now they'll be, the Yukawas will be hierarchical on the same basis, and we'll get roughly something that looks hierarchical here.
Can you explain where the Yukawa hierarchy came from? I mean, maybe I missed it because I came in late, but why do you get basically rank one?
Okay, so let's say I don't turn on any H-flux, why is it rank one? That'll happen because if I look at the, let's try and evaluate these wave functions in this kind of simple setup. So they locally look like you know, Gaussians. They're peaked on the curve, and then they're, you know, kind of falling off rapidly off of the curve. So we see that there's basically a Gaussian profile for one of them like this, and another Gaussian, it's not gonna look good, like this. And the place where they have maximal overlap is at this point. And in fact, you can go to a kind of a delta function limit for the wave function so that it's always concentrated at that point. So what we can do is we can evaluate this wave function in this limit like this. So just evaluate at that point. And now we want to know what the rank of this matrix is. This matrix, I claim, has rank 1. And the reason is that it's an outer product in flavor space. So it's a three vector in this guy and a three vector in this guy. So it'll look like it's a rank 1 matrix, and that's why I'll get just one non-zero value in that element. Does that answer your question?
So the three wave functions were zero modes at different points on a curve, localized at different points on a curve.
The three wave functions are the three wave functions are kind of spread out over the entire curve.
Okay.
So there's like a quark doublet curve. For those like the 10 curve. That the zero mode kind of lives on this entire thing.
Good.
And there's say a 5 Higgs curve. That thing lives over this entire thing here.
Good.
And now what we're doing is we're saying, let's evaluate the overlap of those two wave functions.
Oh, fine.
So the Higgs is like spread out over this entire curve. So as long as I hit some point, like I have to have some point where this guy meets. And then once I do that, I say, now let's evaluate at that point.
Yeah. And the fact that the wave functions are actually spread over the whole curve is actually clear, as opposed to being localized even on the curve.
I think that's generically what you'd expect because it's 6D matter. But you could imagine that, you know, you've turned on a flux in a particular way to kind of like squeeze it into, I don't know, you could imagine that, but I think the more generic situation is that you just have this thing spread out over the entire curve, and then, yeah, and that's the zero mode.
Yeah, yeah, the fact that ring one means the other generation aren't working the same way.
It means that they're massless at this level. So I need to induce a deformation of the superpotential in order to generate hierarchical Yukawas for the rest of those guys. And then the point is that if I turn on, say, some background fluxes, I will indeed induce certain deformations of the superpotential, which will induce now a higher rank structure. So the idea is that the wave function has some particular, you know, Gaussian fall or something like that. If I start turning on these other fluxes, you can start to smear them out. So they're no longer localized at just a point. This can be made sharper by going to kind of a description of this in terms of, say, a non-commutative deformation of the theory. And then the point is that, you know, there's no real point you have anymore, so there's no sense in which you can just evaluate them all at the same point. And so it's kind of intuitively clear that you expect kind of a spread out to occur.
But aren't you supposed to tune this H-flex now? You have triples that aren't in the GFT. When I'm trying to say star, you know, run one,
yeah. What do you mean by triple hierarchy?
Well, you need three families.
Oh, yeah. So I have to get this thing, and I have to get this thing, too. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
So the point is that once you get one of the generations to get a mass in this kind of mechanism, the other guy will also get distorted as well. So, and then the question is, how much does it get distorted? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it coming the right way?
I don't think you have to do. I mean, okay. I mean, you could ask, like, you know, numerically, what's the value of this epsilon? Like how?
Why isn't it epsilon epsilon instead of epsilon epsilon squared? For
instance?
Yeah.
Oh, I understand.
The Dirac equation. How do we see this?
Okay. I understand now. The point is that if I look at the local behavior of the zero modes, they're going to look like roughly one, and then z, and then this is bad notation because I already used z sigma. Roughly like this. This will be the local behavior. I can organize the generations according to their order of vanishing near the point of interest. So because of this, there's a clear sense in which, you know, if there's like a violation. So basically, you can phrase this H-flux in terms of like a violation of a U1 symmetry. This guy has higher U1 charge, and so that's why it's basically geometrizing something like a Frog-Nielsen type of mechanism. So there's a sense in which, indeed, the lightest generation will indeed. It won't go as one epsilon epsilon, but it'll instead go as one epsilon epsilon squared, or epsilon has been rescaled by some power relative to this system. But okay, yeah.
Sorry, just one more question. So by now you've got this complicated collection of discriminant loci.
Yeah.
And now you want to bring these two points together. So maybe some of the other speakers will be addressing this, and you want to pass on to that. But what is the status right now of whether that can be done in a global virus stress context? And is it natural in that context to bring those two singularities together, as you just described?
Well, so it can certainly be done in a virus stress context. The question is,
with a compact base and.
My guess would be that yeah, you can do it. It'll look like a tuning at the level of the complex structure deformations, because what you're doing is you're demanding kind of that something look like a generic codimension 3 enhancement here and a generic codimension 3 enhancement. Now you're demanding that kind of. There's a higher rank enhancement that occurs here. Right. So it looks non-generic from the perspective of the breaking pattern of, say, an associated gauge theory, and the data will also look non-generic from the perspective of the geometry. But, so, I mean, if you wanted to be extremely conservative, you don't actually have to put the points right on top of each other. You just have to put them really close. But then it looks, you know, there's also a sense in which you might say it looks natural to have kind of a higher symmetry, you know, coming out from this point. So, anyway, but yeah. I don't.
You're saying a special point in complex structure modulate space where you have this enhanced symmetry of things colliding is preferred location where you would like to build
that. That's right. It's a demand I want to put on the model in order to.
It's not only
an interesting argument because there's not really a symmetry in there, but there's some kind of structure that's.
Right. That's right. Yeah. So.
It's not a traditional symmetry argument.
That's right. It's not the traditional technical naturalness. But I feel it seems like it's close in that spirit. So I don't know how to. Yeah.
If they actually coincided, would you still have a smooth Calabi-Yau fourfold, or would it break the singularity?
I think it was.
Yes, it's not smooth anyway. I mean, even if you generate all these SU5s and these meta curves,
he wants to have a singularity in the base, right?
Well, the singularity is the singularity of the vibration, but the Clavier as a whole can be smooth. But you're saying that these singularities are...
If there is non-abelian gauge groups, you will have a non-singular Clavier, right? So this you have to blow up anyway. So the singularity.
Well, singularity is fine. It's physically sensible.
But the fiber will be badly singular in any case.
No, the fiber is singular, but that still represents a total space, which
the total space is singular as soon as you have non-abelian gauge symmetry. Period.
Because they're the non-abelian gauge group. I mean, they're the missing states come from, right?
Anytime there's colliding seven brains that give a non-abelian enhancement in 2B language, the total space is singular in the four-fold range.
But you could ask even more if the base becomes singular if you have this E8 points or E6 points. But this is not the case necessarily. Right? So there you would kind of leave the Weierstrass classification and so on.
I think you can also argue physically that you don't expect. So let's say I started from saying E8 seven brain or something like that. You could again imagine. Let's say that there was no obstruction to tilting them off. You could imagine doing breaking patterns like that to, and then you say, well, what's so bad about the point where they all, you know, I forced them all to meet.
Can I make one more comment? I mean, yeah. You say that you tune these things, but you already have to tune them to kind of get the curves to split. I mean, the picture is only generic in the sense of that there is a 5 curve and there is a 10 curve. And everything else you would have to tune, right?
No, I think you would generically expect, say, codimension 3 enhancements.
No. This is true, but you would have to tune that your Higgs and matter curve splits. Right.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I'm just saying there's already some tuning involved in all
that. Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Exactly the same tuning which you would need to make these points come closer.
Yeah.
The same type of tuning.
Can you remind us how you evaluate this epsilon?
By dimensional analysis. So, I mean, so you start with, say, the background flux, and we ask, what's the size of it? So this thing goes as, say, gut scale squared divided by some cutoff squared. And this is how we're roughly estimating. I don't remember whether it's epsilon or epsilon squared. Anyway, but this is the main dimensional analysis tool that we're using. And then you relate this back to asking about what's the natural size of the seven brain. These don't actually have to be, you know. Yeah, so then we relate it back. The M gut. We already know another relation in dimensional analysis that relates these things. After these things. Now, this is not going to be, you know, an exact relation, but the point is that at the level of scaling arguments, it looks like this kind of number comes out. And this thing is already small.
So, can I ask about this?
Yeah.
So the kind of, because the alpha gut is kind of like a Cayley modulus, mm-hmm. And then it's generally hard to have expansions in. I mean, a superpotential in Cayley moduli, you know.
No, this is a statement at the level of just. Suppose I gave you an effective field theory, and I say I have some spurion field that develops a gut scale VEV. that's all we're saying here. And then we're saying what's the relation between that gut scale, VEV, and alpha gut. We're not saying that this epsilon is directly given by the Cayley modulus. If that's what you mean.
It seems that if you're saying kind of epsilon is like alpha gut.
No, I'm saying numerically it has a similar value based on dimensional analysis. I only have one scale in the problem. I have the gut scale, and then I have a cutoff scale in the star.
So
the only way I can...
So if I vary alpha gut, will epsilon vary with it, or are they independent constants?
What do you mean by varying alpha gut? You mean varying the Cayley modulus?
Yeah, so I changed the size of alpha gut. Will epsilon vary with that, or will it stay the same?
Well, by varying this, you mean changing? No, you can still imagine having the gut scale pinned to a particular value, even if you start playing with the closed string modules. These are, there is a sense, it's kind of something I'm working on now, but there's no sense in which you have to really, you know, tie the Cayley modules to the, you can imagine having the, say, a gut seven brain like this, filling some space, and you could imagine supporting the whole thing. You could imagine geometrically collapsing it to a point, but still supporting a non-zero volume in the sense of the open string frame from turning on, say, an NSB field or something like this. So there's no sense in which the Cayley modulus has to be, playing that role. I don't know, does that answer your question? Or?
Not something, so the basic issue, you know, is that normally alpha gut is the real part of a modulus whose imaginary part is an axion. And you mean just from the structure of, you know, a supergravity. And then in that case, it's always hard to have a...
No, but you can, the point here is that you can imagine working in a limit where you shut off gravity and things like that, and you should still be able to make sense of the local model and the size of alpha gut and things like that. So there is a sense in which you should be able to take a parametric limit where you decouple gravity and you'd still be able to talk about alpha gut.
But in global model, this axiom depends only on complex structure moduli Y4, right? It doesn't depend on Keller moduli.
That's right. So the more formal answer is that you can induce a deformation like this by working at the level of the B model and turning on a non-commutative deformation in the 2-0 components of the of the complex structure. That's all you really need to generate an epsilon. Now the numerics, okay, this is an order of magnitude estimate anyway. I mean, it's surprising it works at all. I mean, so
this may be getting a bit too far away, so you just tell me to shut up if you want. But there was discussion also with this kind of Marchesano-Mar Tucci paper, and then the link between that and your work, saying that kind of the VH flux were being generated by an each one, generated by something that would look like a non-perturbative effect coming from seven brains and gene condensation.
You mean if you expand about the GKP ansatz or something like that?
Yeah, and then the H flux would look like, if it's non-perturbative, it would look like something like e to the minus t.
Mm-hmm. That's their statement. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. Do you want to comment or? Yeah.
No.
Okay.
Just can I clarify what your statement is? So, alpha gut is controlled by the volume of the four cycle, presumably.
Yeah.
What is the geometrical object that controls epsilon?
The geometric object that's controlling.
There's some distance over which things are diluting when you turn on the H flux, and what is that distance in the picture?
It's again gut scale radius.
It's not controlled by the volume of the four cycle. That was just your answer to Joe.
That's right. That's right.
So what is the distance in your picture that controls it?
What is the H flux?
The H flux lives. It's in the threefold. It's a threefold. But it'll have components. It'll have components that are localized along along this thing. I mean, you're basically asking me for the normalization of like a spurion field, right? Or
yeah, well, the Froebel-Nielsen language I totally understand. I'm just asking in your picture, what is, so epsilon is some ratio of volumes, presumably, since you're evaluating a wave function overlap, you're saying epsilon gives a small support to it. Where are the wave functions spreading?
Oh, where are they spreading?
What's the thing that controls it? It's not the volume of the divisor, since you just told us it's not the volume of the divisor.
But this is H flux. No, Fizin is controlled by theta and theta related to H flux.
Yeah.
Is there a free cycle in the chromosome where the H
flux
lives?
No, I'm working in a non-compact setting, so I can talk about it in this.
So there's just some sort of ambient H flux.
Yeah, so imagine you're working in, say, like C3 or something like that, and then...
Where are the legs of the H flux, I guess, is a question we can ask you. Are any of the legs in the picture that you've drawn?
Yeah, so the H flux will, okay, related to this non-commutativity parameter, we'll have something that looks like, so let me introduce a theta, this non-commutativity parameter to the problem, so that xi, xj is equal to 1, so theta ij. I can write down an equation that this theta is supposed to satisfy. It'll be something like this.
Sure.
So by non-commutativity, you mean you have some B field along one of these brains, basically?
I mean non-commutativity in the sense of the B model. I don't necessarily mean in the sense of the physical superstring. So it's a deformation of the superpotential. It's not at this level. I'm not actually sure like how it shows up in the D terms.
It is 0.2 on this graph, 0.1, 0.4, but it varies in transverse direction. That's why it has this.
So there's a B field at 0.2. What is 0.2?
B field is 0.2 form on this gut, but it varies in the normal direction.
Fine.
So you get 1.2 form in 3-4.
Fine. And so the spreading is in the normal direction in some sense to the divisor.
No, it can be along the divisor too.
What worries me is that this H flux should be quantized in compact setting. So I don't know in what, but they would say that H controls the size of theta, and that is what precisely controls
Okay.
Fizin.
So you're saying the new distance scale is actually the normal direction to the four cycle, which lets H dilute in a different direction than alpha gut. Mm-hmm. That's what you're saying.
I would say so. Okay. Yeah.
But they are the same order.
Of course.
If it's not very distorted manifold.
So there are these two Kalman modules I'm talking about. One is overall volume, and one is in volume in this local depth.
But this will depend on any Kalman module.
Yeah, that's really the volume of the three cycle, isn't it?
No, I understand
the three cycle,
it's like also
fiddling
little volumes.
Okay.
I have two different questions. What is this cutoff scale? Where does it come from? Is it the Planck scale or?
This is again. It's a little bit lower than the Planck scale. It's basically just. It's asking, where do I expect my description in terms of an 8D gauge theory to start breaking down? So roughly, you could say this is related to the same. If we were talking about, say, perturbative physics, we'd say this is roughly M string. For M string is roughly related to M star. But I mean, so what you can do is you can kind of use dimensional analysis. You can say, I know the volume of the threefold base, and I can relate that now to the Newton's constant in four dimensions. And then I can, and then there'll be some like, you know, appearance of some M star that appears there, based on, you know, like the 10-dimensional gravity action, and then reducing it down to four dimensions. That'll give you one relation, so it'll be something like M star to the eighth times volume of V3. So you can use this to deduce what the value of say Newton's constant. So this will give you one relation, and then you're making some guess for, and then you have some other relation. It relates, alpha gut like this. And then since we claim to know what alpha m gut should be, we claim to know what this is, we can start to figure out what m star is, and we can also, you know, figure out what the volume of this threefold base should be. Does that, okay.
My other question is about the plots again. It's, you said you use an index theory to compute the net chirality. Of course, you want to avoid to have extra non-chirality generations. Is it something that's very easy or comes out naturally, or do you have to pick some very specific fluxes to avoid extra non-chirality matter?
For non-chiral matter, it seems that in global compactifications, it becomes more difficult to kind of satisfy the constraint that you have. You don't generate extra non-chiral matter beyond that in the standard model. At the level of just getting the chiral matter right, it seems to be fine. But it indeed seems more complicated if you want nothing else.
But of course, your whole motivation of the gut breaks down if you introduce extra matter, which would totally spoil the
matter. Not necessarily. You could. Not necessarily.
Functions run with everything that's charged under the gauge.
Incomplete gut multiplet.
Yeah. So even if it's in an incomplete gut multiplet, you could still imagine a field theory mechanism to lift the vector-like pairs to some very high mass. So I mean, if I wanted to be, you know, extremely dirty and non-minimal, I could just add an extra singlet and then have that thing couple to the vector-like pair, give that thing a gigantic VEV, and then that's. It doesn't affect the running.
It would be a string miracle if you generically end up with extra vector-like pairs, really. Maybe in some approximation you do. There's no reason for that to happen. So unless there's a symmetry that protects the extra vector-like pair.
Yeah.
You know, that.
Yeah, but let's play devil's advocate and say that there is a symmetry protecting it. You could imagine now that there's.
Then you have to break it by hand.
Yeah, but even that is not, it's not the end of the earth, even if that's there. I mean, it's, yeah. I mean, of course, you'd like it not to be there, but.
Isn't this model concrete enough that you can tell whether it's there or not?
Well, at this point, all I've formulated is kind of half of a wish list.
if you start with just a line model on P1, so if these intersection curves are just P1s, then you don't get any non-chiral matter at all in the first place. Just by an experiment, it's just the cohomology classes on P1. It's always N0 or 0N.
Yeah.
Okay. So we don't have to worry about this question at all. Then you don't have to worry about this question. So you can engineer, in principle.
Yeah.
We want these extra states.
Okay. So I wanted to put these things together. And then the other thing that we wanted to do is we wanted to put in, say, a model for neutrinos. So what happens when you put all this together? So here are the neutrinos, for example. You'd want to have something like an interaction term like you'd want to have a superpotential term like this. Or you'd like to have, say, this is in the case of Majorana neutrino, or you'd like to have, say, a Dirac neutrino like this. So what you'd like to have here is you'd like to have some singlet, it's a bar, and then lepton doublet, and then Higgs. So these guys will be supported on the gut 7 brain. And then your right-hand neutrino will in general be localized on some other curve poking out of the in the normal direction to the 7 brain. That'll give us some cubic terms like that. So what happens if you try to put this together, and then you demand that the neutrino interaction point also goes to the same point? So unifying, say, E6, SO12, or 5-10-10, 5-bar, 5-bar-10, and in the right-hand neutrinos, demands that there's some point like this. There's an E8 structure. So then the picture is that you have, say, a singlet sticking out like this, and you have all the other curves coming in to this point of E8. And then there's and then it looks like, say, SU6 over some of them, and SO10 over some of them out here. Okay.
That sounds really interesting because you can't really go beyond E8 normally in that theory, right? That's sort of the maximal.
That's right. That's right. So there was just enough room to get this to work, and that's what's interesting about it. I mean, you could have said, there's no guarantee this is going to work, and it, you know, will just break down. Like, the fact that you can do it at all, I think that's an interesting question. That's an interesting point. Okay, so what's the breaking pattern look like?
In principle, you can imagine that this E8 is an heterotic E8, right? Part of the
if
you somehow manage to localize the boundary.
Yeah, so the geometric data for sure. The thing that you might be concerned about is, say, breaking the gut group. But even there, I mean, there could be some, like, you know.
Yeah, even there, like Flanagan said.
Yeah. Okay. So let's.
And there you go. You can't put the Susie breaking sector right on top of that, for example.
No, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put the E8 stuff. I'm going to put the Susie breaking sector inside of that E8 too.
Oh, in it. Okay.
So there's going to be just enough room for me to stick a Susie breaking sector, and then the question is going to be, how constrained is the Susie breaking sector?
So far you just explained how to get the normal matter, but now.
That's right. That's right. So now what I'm going to move to is indeed to ask, let's say I want to put everything in there. Can I do it, or am I just forced to kind of, you know, add an extra module to my model?
If you would do that, the thing happens which I mentioned before. The base would become singular. And some new non-deterministic effects would have to blow up the base, and then.
No, I can't add any other similarities to this thing. Like, but what he was saying is he can get more out of the E8 than he already got.
No, no. If you want to add more, then the base becomes singular, and then you have to add more non-deterministic stuff, and then you have these instruments.
I think you're saying the same thing. Which is that, one, you want to say that there's just an E8, and then if I try to add more than just the E8, I might encounter problems.
Yeah.
So then what that suggests is, let's try and use the E8 as much as I can to try and put the rest of the.
No, but I'm just saying that these objects have been studied. What happens there has been.
You can add more.
You can add more, and then kind of more exotic objects appear.
But so you don't.
Potential streams and
streams. So if I just start slowly, because E8 is this Z to the 5 type singularity.
Yeah.
Z to the 6 causes a decomposition. So if it's like dimension 1, you can't add more. But you're saying at higher co-dimension, you could add more without getting a decompactification type singularity. Oh, okay, so that seems important to understand whether you really restrict this or not.
Yeah, so I think when you work in a local patch, it'll typically look like it's E8, but then if you try to even complete it over the whole gut surface, then it's not totally clear whether you have to fit it inside of a single E8 or whether kind of maybe it gets glued in some funny way to another structure. This is something I don't understand very well, and I think it's indeed an important thing to kind of settle. Okay.
That's much. Yeah.
E9 is hard to get.
Well, you can get E9, but it's always at the kind of like the gauge bosons are always massive. So you could imagine.
But here the gauge bosons are also massive, so maybe that's.
But there's a sense in which I could have contemplated an E8 gauge theory.
Yes.
There's no sense in which I can really contemplate the E9 gauge theory. So there always has to be kind of Higgs, or I always have some problem
And just make a quick comment. I mean, one, if you have a heterotic tool, for example, what happens is you could imagine that it's like the E8 on the other side and the heterotic side, right?
On the other side?
On the heterotic side, you have an E8, and in the F theory, you have an E8. And then what happens is that you have to include some M5 brains on the heterotic side, which correspond to this further enhancement. So you get some tensor multiplex in 6 dimensions and so on. So.
But you can't go beyond the
E8.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's now try and ask what the breaking pattern is for E8 that we've written down. So we want, okay, well, you can split it up into 2 SU5 factors. And then the breaking pattern here we can parameterize in terms of some something like this. So we can imagine something that's adjoint valued inside of this SU5 perp, and then we're just specifying a particular breaking pattern down to, say, SU5 times one extra U1 factor. And then the idea is that we start from the 248. We'll have things like 5s and 10s and 10s and 5 bars, and then conjugates, and then adjoints. Okay, so for example, if I want the 5 of SU5, it comes from here. And then it looks like it transforms as a 10 under this thing. And then the particular U1 structure that we have for this breaking pattern to U1 to the fourth and down further, that's dictated by, you know, this piece of the representation. So we can kind of see how all of this is going to go. Now, why am I demanding something like a U1 Peche-Quinn, some extra thing beyond this? I want this to forbid, for example, a bare mu-turn. So if these Higgses are charged under this extra U1, then I can forbid this type of superpotential coupling at the bare level. That means, however, that I need to generate it through the bev of some guy. And one way to do it is to introduce something like this. So let's imagine now that there's an extra singlet. So I can get gut singlets by looking at something that transforms in the adjoint of SU5 perp. So X can live in here. Yeah, it's a Giudice-Mazziero type thing, but the difference here is that we're integrating out Kaluza-Klein modes, and so the suppression scale is not in Planck, but it's rather, it's a lower scale. It's the Kaluza-Klein scale set by kind of the KK modes of
that. That means you're going to set your F term for some reason other than to get the standard model masses right. You're going to set your F term by getting mu right.
That's right.
The F over MKK has to be what normally F over M Planck would be.
That's right, exactly.
So you get a very high scale gauge mediation if MKK is high.
That's right. But it's not going to be gravity mediation.
No, right.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as MKK is parametrically below.
That's right. So the point is, I'm already learning something about the way I should try and build my Suzy breaking sector just from kind of some really crude, just demanding this crude coupling be present. Okay.
Yeah, the gravitino will still be the output.
Dark matter, you want the gravitino to be dark matter, or? Yeah. So the gravitino is indeed a natural candidate for. So it comes out around 10 to 100 MeV in this, and so it's in the range where it can play the role of a dark matter candidate. So it's, and then you have to say, well, a lot of these dark matter signals are going to go away, but it's in the range where it can do something interesting.
So the U1PQ becomes necessary now because the two Higgs curves meet again, right? If you stuck to this picture there where the two Higgs curves are split, then U1PQ is not necessary to avoid the Higgs term, the mu term, the tree level.
Well, if there's...
But it is necessary for proton decay, to avoid proton decay, dimension 5 appearance.
No one can have a missing particle.
No, it doesn't help because they couple to Kaluza-Klein modes and you get generated this dimension 5 dangerous appearance. It's fact of life.
Are you asking whether if I put the Higgs up and Higgs down on the same curve or different curves?
Recap your logic. The U1PQ is now necessary because the Higgs up and the Higgs down meet again. So first you split the two to avoid this term, the two Higgs curves. But now they meet in your E8 point again, and that's why you might again generate the mu terms.
Oh, this is why you might be concerned. Yeah. You might be concerned that there's some limit where the curves could kind of, you know, not be degenerate and just like smooth out into one curve, unless there's something like a U1 symmetry which is going to forbid that. So, yeah. Yeah, so indeed, the breaking pattern we're talking about is one where we're just kind of demanding that they don't ever get to, you know, fill out and make one big curve.
Actually, now I'm confused by something. So you're going to set your F term so that F over MKK is TEV-ish.
Yeah.
And now separately engaged mediation, there's a messenger mass.
That's right.
Which you would a priori now have to tune to the KK scale. So that's one question. Why is the messenger mass the same as the KK scale?
No, the messenger mass will be lower.
Well, then F over M will be, there's a factor of G in between, is that what you're saying?
No, there'll be, sorry, I don't understand what you're asking. You're saying, so I write down, let's say.
So FX over MKK is set by this term, right?
Yeah.
So FX over MKK is TEV.
Mm-hmm.
You also need, you know, some factors of G times F over the messenger mass to be about a TEV.
Well, yeah, so the other scale that I want is, yeah, indeed, I want F over M, for example, engaged mediation,
yeah,
to be like 10 to the 5 GeV.
Yeah, so there's one factor of G squared in there that gets you up there. So what explains the ratio of M to MKK? It's just a tune?
At this point, it's just a tuning that I'm doing. I don't have a good reason for why. I mean, you can see M is going to come out to be about 10 to the 12 GeV. So the numerical values of the scales would be F like this. And now if I imagine gem squared, and then this will be then stuff like this. At this point, it's just...
Okay, but that's crucial, because otherwise your mu term has the wrong side. So this tune is actually built into the model. It's not...
Right, it's an assumption that that I have to make in order to make the thing even mildly viable.
Okay.
So... I kind of jumped over it. It's coming. It's located in the VEV of this guy. So it's a singlet that lives. So let's imagine that we have the other singlet here.
This is all part of the EA.
Yeah. So X is getting stuck inside.
I'm just asking one question before going to the VEV of F. Is just so this term, this Judy-Gemazier term, doesn't have an alpha gap in front. As we just saw. So you generate it as ingravity mediation. How do you generate this term?
No, you generate it by integrating out Kluze-Klein modes on the curve.
But to call it GDG-Mazier is a little wrong, because there the scales are all the same. You get the right scale soft terms when you write down the F over M plug. And sure. Here you get the wrong scale soft terms, so it's just a random higher derivative correction.
But then it looks like ingravity mediation. So,
well, with KK mediation, I mean, yes.
Yes, but what prevents KK mediation to generate all the terms? Okay.
Yeah, no. So what prevents it is that if he sets a messenger scale there, then what's going to happen is the, it's a little confusing. Why won't this give equal contributions as compared with the messengers and screw up flavor?
Oh, you're asking, okay, so I understand. You're asking, what about...
exactly. So those are MKK squared suppressed.
Well,
now they'll compete on equal footing with gauge mediation.
No, actually, they're going to be, the leading contribution is typically from, not from, the reason why this is special is that you're integrating out Kaluza-Klein modes localized on this curve. So now the question is, what Kaluza-Klein mode are you going to integrate out to generate this guy? There is no Kaluza-Klein mode that kind of knows about all of these guys at the same time.
You're saying you get a distance suppression?
So there's an X here and there's an Q here. The reason why this guy came out okay is because I was just integrating out one guy here. Now what I need is some kind of transmission from guys localized here to guys localized here.
And that gives you a suppression by one over a distance of some sort?
Yeah, roughly. Okay.
What dynamics induces the F term for X?
At this point, I'm just assuming that somebody has handed me, you know, the VEV of the spurion, and I'm going to leave it at that for this discussion. You might want to say that it's generated by something like instantons or something like that, but at the level of my...
That's what's going on within all the same structure.
So that can happen. Okay, yeah, I understand. So you can imagine in like a minimal setup like this that the dynamics of how the X gets set could be coming from, say, here's the SU5 gut, and then there's... I have this other U1 in the story, the U1PQ. That's some other 7 brain in the story. So, and then there's, you know, this X field that kind of lives here. X is charged under U1PQ if we work out the breaking patterns. So what we might hope is that the dynamics of the U1PQ 7 brain itself will be enough to set the VEV of X in some way and generate Suzy breaking. Now that hasn't really been done in any, you know. What do you mean? This thing could be like, you know, participating in other things like this. I mean, all I need is to generate. Right, I could imagine, say, I mean, I could imagine it's a non-minimal setup when I'm coupling this to an RFID model or something like this. It's not. I mean, at this point, I'm just going to leave it, though. It's saying somehow the X is getting a bev.
Maybe I missed that, but could you try to put a discrete global symmetry instead of a two-one-bit symmetry?
Yeah. I think you... The question is, how easy is it to get these kind of discrete symmetries to kind of pop out of the of a compactification? It's not totally clear that it's really easy to get these discrete symmetries to come out. But I mean, if you phrase it in this language in terms of like these breaking patterns like this, it could be that, you know, there's just some discrete subgroup inside of say SU5 or something like this you might try and use to. But it seems harder. Okay, so that's okay.
You don't want to have any additional gauge group to do any kind of
thing. No, I mean the UNPQ is kind of it's off in its own realm.
You just do SU5 plus U1, right? As a gauge
group. Well, but I do know that there will be other gauge groups, like at somewhere, just by tadpole cancellation. So.
But then it's not the gauge.
That's right. Yeah. So that's not part of.
Coming out of the age, right?
That's right. so I'm just telling you, you know, kind of one dirty way to do it. I think it'd be interesting to know whether you can completely rule out the you know doing it with just the UNPQ. Okay. Let's see. Where am I? So Susie breaking. So we already kind of talked about how you said mu term. The idea is that we're going to try and get. Gauge mediation. We're going to try and stick it at the same point, or have it coming out of the same. Okay. So now I'm going to try and add in minimal gauge mediation, or MGM. So the idea is that I have some Susie breaking sector, and then I have some messenger sector. And then I have, say, the MSSM at the end. The idea is that here is where I set the Susie breaking bevs through X. It gets communicated, at least in some minimal setup, through vector-like pairs of some guys and some F-term like this. And then this gets fed down into this through loop interactions through standard model gauge bosons to, say, soft mass terms. So they'll go as kind of square root of the Dugin index here for the messengers, and then say some F over M. Okay, and then these guys will go as Dugin index. Okay, so the one crucial scale I have to get right is F over M, and that's set once I know F, it sets this M to this. Okay, so the first thing that happens, So comment one on this is that, first of all, the messenger scale is kind of high. Comment two is that the representation content of the messengers is constrained by trying to stick it inside of E8. It does not seem as easy to get messengers to come in 5 plus 5 bars. So getting them in 10 plus 10 bars seems a lot easier. And that's important because if we look at, say, the value of this Dinkin index, it affects the relative splittings between the gauginos and the scalars. So this is roughly, this is 2. So what it does is it causes the scalars to shift down relative to the gauginos. The third effect.
The messenger scale is that then also the mass scale of this messenger here?
Yeah, sorry. So what happens is that I say now X develops a bev, like this. And then we'll get something that looks like plus now kind of F times now in my effective Lagrangian. So the idea is that if I look at now the masses of the fermions in Y versus the scalars, they'll have different masses. So that split in the mass spectrum for the messengers will then get fed to the visible sector.
Where are the lines coming from?
There? Yeah, they're coming from here. Right. So you want, say, Y to come from here, and you'd want... So the point is that I've already used up a lot of matter curves to try and get the visible sector right, so I don't have much stuff left over. And the stuff that's left over seems to be in tens.
But sorry again. But I mean, again, about GH coupling unification, it's you need your 10 and 10 bars to have a mass which is at the Scott scale or higher.
No, the tens come in a complete gut multiplet, so it's okay for me to kind of put them at any scale I want, and I'll still retain a unification at one loop level.
Unification works if you add complete gut multiplets. It just shifts the energy at which unification occurs. To actually spoil a unification, you have to add incomplete multiplets.
So the gut scale is not 10 to the 60.
It moves. That's right, it moves down. But not by much, because these messengers are so heavy, they barely have time to affect the running. And it might move to 10 to 15 or something.
Okay, so that's one comment.
You fixed the messenger scale because you had fixed the new term, right?
That's right.
From the new term, you get the F term.
Right, so the logic was I fix the F term through mu, and then I demand F over M come out correctly for a gauge mediation, and that fixes M. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then you're tuning mu b mu by hand.
No, I'm not tuning b mu.
Well, b mu, Well, assuming b mu is the order of the spelling mass.
B mu is going to get generated. The main contribution to B mu comes from this. I don't know. I might have the wrong number of powers here. But anyway, so it'll come from something like this. The point is that some of these come with F term components, and some of them come with M's. So you get some extra suppression for B mu. Okay. So on top of the gauge mediation contribution, there's also the effect of having this anomalous U1 in the story. And gauge boson exchange from that guy will indeed generate something that's flavor diagonal, but it's some shift. So there's some term like this, and then what this does is it causes a shift in the soft masses. So we'll have the usual contribution for a minimal gauge mediation, and then there'll be some number, and then there'll be something like F over MPQ quantity squared. And I'll just call the whole thing here delta PQ squared. So this is shifting the soft scalar masses. So. But it does not shift the gauge unit. Okay.
How can you be sure that gravity mediation doesn't spoil your picture?
Okay, so let's estimate the size of the Planck suppressed operators. So it'll be generated by something like F over M Planck.
Okay, KK suppressed operators are a much more serious worry here.
That's right. Yeah. So the main issue would be whether you can get rid of the KK suppressed operators. I agree.
Yeah.
But the Planck's ones they'll be suppressed because this will be something like 17 J squared, so on. So it's down compared to the weak scale. If you see what I mean. It's like order 10 to the minus 2 GeV now. Right. So this will be like.
So you're assuming that all your Planck moduli are stabilized supersymmetrically, and there are no external. That's the thing. What you mean? Right?
Bulk moduli that the gut sees. Yeah, I'm making yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's the shift in this. So it leads to okay. So there are two things that the E8 is buying us, or at least three things. One is messenger scale. One is. roughly messenger scale. One is representation content of the messengers, and the third is a shift in the soft masses relative to what they would have been in minimal gauge mediation. The Z primes. So what's the mass of the Z prime that you're thinking of? Right, right, yeah. So the difference here is that the Z prime mass for us is up near the gut scale because it's an anomalous E1. But, I mean, yeah, you can have.
What exactly does the shift depend on F? Because that's not the.
Why does the shift depend on F?
What exactly is it that it depends on from the compactification?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
From the compactification data, what exactly is it that
this shift?
The number.
It depends on the Suzy breaking scale and the mass of the PQ gauge boson. That's the data that we're, and we don't know those values, so we're just going to scan over them. So let's imagine that we fixed F. I don't know the mass of the PQ gauge boson. So I'm just going to scan over possible masses. And I have a reason to suspect it's near the gut scale, just because the rest of the dynamics is near the gut scale. So it's in a range where it might do something interesting. So that's why I'm going to keep it in the story. But, I mean, if you say it's, you know, a phenomenological disaster to include it, I mean, you can push it up to 10 to the 19 GeV and then the shift goes away.
One more question? I mean, if you're including an anomalous U1,
yeah,
then there is basically a theorem that there's another field you have to keep that can't decouple from your sector any more than the gauge boson can, which is the field whose shift cancels the anomaly by the Green-Schwarz mechanism.
Yeah, that's right.
Your philosophy in general has been to ignore bulk moduli, but that guy you really can't ignore if you're going to include the effects of the PQ. So what is your philosophy about that guy?
My philosophy about that guy is that I'm going to... So that guy is basically the volume of the PQ... 7 brain. So my philosophy about this guy is that you can kind of cook up toy model potentials where this guy is, you know, frozen in such a way that it does not affect this discussion. But at this
but
point,
you can never formally decouple even in a toy model. I mean, that's a theorem.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
How are you cooking up potentials?
Well, I'm just gonna. So, what you do is you basically write down. You know, you can just write down Polony type terms. So you would write down something like this.
Yeah, but how can you trust your guess of a field theory? I mean, in all perturbative string theories, people are doing really hard computations to get even the first terms seriously. And how
no, I agree. I agree. The approach is a little bit different. I'm asking what would be necessary in order to make it work. It could be that at the level of the effective field theory, it's just broken and it won't work. In which case, you know, there's no point in even trying to engineer this at the level of a full-fledged string compactification. I'm really taking kind of like a first step to ask, could I do it?
I'm just worried from the four-dimensional field theory of point that maybe your moduli, you know, your four-dimensional fields are maybe mixings of your original moduli. That's something that generically happens, that you have, for example, some kind of one-loop mixing of the moduli, and then you cannot say you want to decouple this sector and this sector, because in the correct canonical formulation in the four-dimensional field theory, they are all mixed up. So how do you avoid that?
No, I can parameterize. At this kind of crude level, I can just parameterize in terms of a set of some guys that have some shift symmetry, and I can just ask, let's introduce them. There could be like N of them, and we can just ask, how do they couple into the X and all that? I mean, I'm not giving you a compactification, a full-fledged compactification to do this. I'm just asking, what are the conditions to do it?
The mass of this scalar modulus, when it pitches Quinlis, schläge to the axion, this is frozen by D-term, right? This is not automatically included. I mean, you don't
have to. Yeah. So you have to.
Pick it up, this is what I mean. I mean, you just.
The D-term is there, but what you might want to do is you might want to demand that kind of. There's a sense in which you've got to cook up this scale coming out low. So So there's already mechanisms there.
Mechanism to make it massive, for sure.
But that's right. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The mechanism to make it massive will freeze some combination of a modulus and an open string.
Sure.
So
just get a modulus dependent FI term. This is what you get. Yeah.
Why does this term matter, but the term that would have been x dagger x q dagger q over mkk squared doesn't? There you said, well, they're distant, and so there's a suppression. That doesn't apply to integrating out the MPQ gauge boson?
It's because x and q are both charged under MPQ.
Oh, okay.
So that's why it's coming in as, I think, the leading effect.
Okay.
Okay.
Can you solve the problem with the D term that you kind of, you have this runaway direction, so you have this flat direction, and you have a way to avoid this?
Well, I mean, for example, let's imagine we're in a Rafferty model. I mean, you can say that there's a flat direction in a Rafferty model, but then there will be some, you know, lifting of that direction. I mean, I don't want to get into the, you know, details of, you know, how you do it, because I don't know how to build it in general. But I mean,
so you have a couple of phi model with some constant phi inductance term.
Well, flux-induced modulus-dependent phi term, not just a constant, but yeah, something.
Yeah, sorry, one more question about fluxes again. Do you have some statement here as well that you can't get chirality if you put a flux on the same cycle or so?
Flux on the same cycle is what?
Oh, well, you know, we know in the type 2 string series that you have either flux or chirality somehow. You can't freeze a modulus field if you want to have chirality at the same location, basically. Do you have some kind of...
Oh, I understand what you're asking. Yeah. I think that's a separate issue from what I'm saying here, but... Yeah, I think it's. I understand what you're saying. That typically, like when you try to induce chiral fluxes, some of the mechanisms you would like to use to stabilize moduli are now obstructed. But I'm not sure exactly how that plays out here. So I don't know if it's a huge problem or not.
Well, isn't
it fair
to say you're not addressing moduli stabilization?
That's very fair to say. Yes. Yeah.
I think this is still a very big problem. Gauge radiation can truly be realized in string theory.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. I was suggesting this problem, you know, in the first lecture.
Sorry,
what
is the problem?
I mean, really, to stabilize the moduli such that this mechanism he was proposing really works in a global model. So, and then you also use Fi, you know, Fi parameters which are moduli dependent, and you can't fix them by hand before, and you can't treat them as constants, you have to treat them dynamically.
So what,
and then you always have this runaway minimum, as Thomas was saying.
What
do you use? You have problems. If you have chirality, you get extra zero most for the instance. If you really consider this true, I mean, taking all these string consistency conditions into account, many of the mechanisms you can cook up in field theory, you really don't work in string theory.
So you have to get uniformization? You can't engineer it such that you have...
There's always one, what he's saying is there's always one anomalous U1 when you have the chiral standard model. That anomalous U1 has a modulus that you have to fix by something more general than a condensate in that 7-brain stack. That's a true statement.
I know.
Now, the fact that would prefer gauge or gravity mediation seems remarkable to me. It's an equal problem for both, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't see why it says anything about gauge versus gravity mediation. But it is true that in the presence of chirality, you can't use an instanton per cycle.
Oh, yeah. It's more an issue of stabilizing modulus.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the chiral brain.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's not stabilization. I mean, this is some modular input. This one I would like to have. Can we really truly realize this in string theory? Does it consistently couple to gravity?
That's right.
This is just a summary, you know, collection of future inputs we would like to have, but you know.
That's right.
It cannot be realized at the same time.
There's also this thing, I mean, because particularly with things like low-scale gauge mediation, you know, I mean, in the phenomenological literature, because there's always this just basic assumption that all contributions to the gravitational mass, you know, in some cases bigger than, say, like 10 to the minus 3 electron volt, you know, you just put this constant, you know, M3/2 or W0, something, you know, in the phenomenological literature. And in string theory, I mean, anything which comes in, any contribution to the superpotential giving you a gravitational mass above a TeV, I mean, instantly kills...
Yeah, but the field theorists aren't stupid. There's a natural reason that you can do that, which is R-symmetry. So you'd have to claim that string theory violates Tuff naturalness, because an R-symmetry can ensure that W is zero. And if you have an exponentially broken R-symmetry, it can give you small W. So anytime somebody wants a small W, there's a very Tuff natural way to do it.
But then you've got to get, you know, actually say, well, in string theory, can you actually really put a thing where you say, here's the model, and there are no contributions to the superpotential, exponential, any kind, which are bigger than, say,
right. Again, 10 minus 20. What I was trying to do is restate your very difficult-sounding thing as, you need an R symmetry. That's not a profitable way to look at things. You could say you need to forbid all operators of any dimension, or you could say you need a symmetry. So I'm just trying to say a symmetry will do it. That's why field theorists do it all the time.
So the thing about the instanton zero mode is an exact statement, or once you break super symmetry and so on, you might generate zero, you might kill those zero modes and you have the instanton. How strong is
it going to be
making
up? I think, well, depends on that, but you have to make sure, if you have a chiroreceptor, if you have an instanton, so you have to make sure that this instanton doesn't intersect any of the brains you have in the story. Once you have an intersection, you have to make sure that there are no extra zeromodes coming up. It's a general situation that you get extra zeromodes.
And those zeromodes are chiral inserts?
They can, I mean, if they are chiral, they are very dangerous,
yes,
of course.
Yes.
But even if they are non-chiral, you have to think, you have to treat them correctly. Because if you have non-chiral zeromodes, they do something. They generate for you, for instance, the ADS superpotential. These come from non-chiral zeromodes. So, and then you have again charged matter fields and the couplings. But you want to, you know, if you want to freeze model line, I mean, just close string model line, for instance. And you can't use such a term. I mean, of course you can use, but then you have also to include all your charged matter already in the freezing process. Because, you know, treat this, you know, just freeze, first freeze, you know, the complex structure model and the Kähler model and forget about the matter fields. Then you have to do all at the same time. Yeah?
Is it a possibility that the non-chiral vector-like stuff is lifted at some level?
You would say that you need a non-supersymmetric background to it. I mean, if the background is supersymmetric.
Right, but the background, at the end of the day, the background is not going to be exactly supersymmetric.
But you probably don't want to break it explicitly from the very beginning. But you want to do it, right? Explicitly understand.
But the posting breaking of supersymmetry.
I think what Ralph's asking for is an explicit model that has the standard model with all moduli stabilized. Yeah. That's the full statement, right?
Yeah.
Or a chiral model.
Oh, just a chiral model, not the standard model. Okay.
But it's not a sharp no-go. I'm just asking.
No, it's not a sharp no-go, but there are concerns, you know, because string theory gives you a lot of extra conditions beyond field theory.
But I think you would say that for vector-like models, we have very little concern at this point in the sense of existence.
Yeah, of course you can. I mean,
so the new issue is just chirality and what it is as humans.
But also to freeze instanton, not chiral instanton zero mode, I think. This is also important. I think you kind of say, well, I make a massive and the general.
No, you use O1.
This means actually integrating the charge matter field.
So you kind of use O1 instantons, and then you don't have to worry about extra vector models.
If they are present, yes.
I think the difficulty here is that the spurion field is charged under, so the chirality is built in.
That's why I asked him the question. with exactly these anomalous U1s, you definitely cannot decouple the modulus and keep the U1. There's just no such limit.
It is open-ended, but not really open-ended. So maybe it would be a good time to wrap up, and people can continue with lunch.
Okay.
Discussions at lunch. Maybe could you wrap up?
Okay. So since I have. Okay, 2 minutes? Okay, so you can put all these effects together, and what it seems to prefer is that, number one, the stau is the NLSP, and then this limit where I'm talking about just using the value of the gravitational mass I get from this kind of relation, this thing comes out around 10 to 100 MeV. And the stau comes out as the NLSP around 100 to 200 GeV. Okay. Now, there's also the possibility that depending on the values of this thing, the Beano is also. Okay. Now, why is this interesting? This is the kind of thing that's quite easy to see at the LHC. So this is the kind of thing, I mean, as opposed to this kind of thing, which would be kind of just look like some missing energy, the Suzy breaking scale means that this thing is going to be quasi-stable on the time scales that a collider would probe, and has a lifetime of roughly 1 second to an hour. And on top of that, it's charged. So what it'll look like, basically, a heavy muon going through the detector. And this is the kind of thing you can see. You can use it for lots of things, like reconstructing masses of other sparticles. So it's a much cleaner scenario than in some of these missing energy scenarios. So anyway, it looks like in a lot of these models, at least if you scan over the parameter space, Stout comes out as a possible NLSP. Looks interesting for LHC. Maybe I should stop there. Okay, so thank you.